you. Okay, we'll wait a minute till everyone... Case number 2 is 032056, United States of America versus Garcia Parra and Magdalena Correa. And Mr. Stengel, you're going to go first. Good morning.
Good morning, may it please the court. Judges Cudahy, Rovner, and Wood. My name is Attorney Pat Stengel. I represent Arturo Garcia Parra, the appellant in this appeal. Prior to beginning my argument, I just would like to point out to the court for the record that in preparing for my argument, I noticed there's a typographical error in my brief which misstates a quote attributed to Agent Becca. It doesn't misstate the quote, but it indicates that it's on a different page. So on page 26 of my brief, it says that the quote about Agent Becca's testimony regarding Arturo Garcia acting in a counter-surveillance role actually cites the page in the transcript relating to Magdalena Correa. So that should be page 115, and in the appendix it should be page 15 instead of page 26.
Okay.
So let me apologize for that oversight.
No, thank you very much for that. That's very helpful.
The focal point of my argument today is really upon the reliability of the principles and methodology and the reliable application of that methodology to the facts in this case by Agent Jerome Becca. As the court is aware, he offered testimony that Arturo Garcia Parra was involved in this conspiracy and acting as a lookout or in a counter-surveillance role.
You know, your brief suggests that an expert's methods have to be verifiably reliable by some objective measure. Isn't it possible that depending on the type of expertise that is claimed, a district judge can make an assessment of whether the principles and methods have been reliably applied to the facts of the case without seeing data, without seeing studies or other evidence that demonstrates something like a success rate or an error rate?
Well, Your Honor, I would concede that the answer to that is yes, and at least in this circuit, you know, agents are typically qualified based on experience, but...
Well, and just to follow
sure.
up, I mean, it seems to me you have an uphill battle in this circuit to the point that you're effectively asking us to overrule quite a few cases, because not only generally have we said that law enforcement officers with extensive experience in the narcotics business can testify as experts based on that experience, but we've even thought about counter-surveillance in United States against Soto, for example, which is a little while back, but nonetheless still good law. So it strikes me that particularly in light of the Supreme Court's decision, Kumho Tyre, the amendment to Rule 702, we've gotten away from the strict phrasing of the Daubert case itself, which made it sound like you had to be a university professor publishing in peer-reviewed journals to be an expert. That's a way to be an expert, but the court's been very clear it's not the only way. So what's wrong here with Agent Becca?
I think the problem is twofold. Is how does one really assess reliability? It's almost as if ipsy dixit, because an agent testifies that someone is acting that way, that's what they are.
Well, so you're going back to the very beginnings of the common law. I mean,
well, I don't think
judges do it every single day. They have to do that.
No, I'm well aware of that, Your Honor. But my the factors in Daubert doesn't mean they're now erased. It doesn't mean that they're not a guideline that should be considered in making that determination.
But the court has gone beyond Daubert, and if the district court judge, as this judge did, make sure that the claimed experience is real experience. You know, you can cross-examine on the bases for this individual's expertise. You know, you could if it were relevant in a case to understand the internal workings of a car, you know, you might put a car mechanic on who's worked on cars for the last 30 years of his life. Well, he hasn't published peer review articles in journals, but if he's worked on every kind of car, he can. There's no reason why such a person couldn't be qualified.
I understand the court's point, but let's assume the qualifications aren't an issue, which this court reviews de novo. That doesn't mean they're necessarily helpful in this particular case to the jury, and there still is a helpfulness requirement that has to be met. And I think the problem with this particular testimony is twofold. One, I don't think it was necessary to help the jury, because unlike a criminal case where testimony is offered by an agent who in the abstract comes in and testifies about certain persons were acting a certain way, and then an agent comes in and gives his opinion that, well, that's typical of drug organizations, there's lookouts, there's et cetera, the jury had the very evidence to look at that Becca based his opinion on.
Do you think the average juror has experience in what a drug transaction looks like, how it operates, the various roles of the participants?
Generally, no. But I think a factor that weighs into this is there was not a lot of evidence bringing in, at least in my opinion, Mr. Arturo Garcia Parra, in this conspiracy.
The judge did instruct the jury on this point, didn't he?
An instruction was given to the jury that an expert testified, and they can, I mean, as a basic instruction, that's correct, Judge. I see my time's actually up for the court.
Okay.
Have any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I reserve my other time for rebuttal.
Sure. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Ruth. I'm the attorney for the defendant appellant, Magdalena Correa. The focus of our appeal is whether the district court erred in finding that there was probable cause to arrest Ms. Correa. And it's our assertion that you should reverse, principally because the district court failed to defer to the expertise of Agent Jerry Becca. This, in some ways, this is the flip side of the other argument. The one side says he's not an expert, and the government says he is an expert. And in this particular instance, the government is right. Jerry Becca is an expert. He testified to that on this particular question of probable cause. Now, our case law has a long history of looking to expert opinion, particularly with respect to agents, when it comes to the subtleties and nuances of the drug trade. And Jerry Becca testified that he has 20 years' experience as a drug agent and that he is well-versed in these particular subtleties.
But, you know, the thing about this is, even if Mr. Becca thought that it would have been more prudent to have to exchange a few words with her, you know, maybe take it a little slower, what the government's relying on is the collective knowledge of all of the agents involved in this, and they summarize around page 53 and following in their brief what that collective knowledge added up to. I would certainly agree with you. You could probably pluck any one of these things out of the blue, and maybe that wouldn't be enough. But collectively, these people were all in communication with each other, and this much was known.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, the question of collective knowledge in this particular case, you can't look at what the government has cited, because that's actually two issues. The government, when it argues collective knowledge, it is arguing everything that was in the suppression hearing and everything from the trial.
But what we need to know, I understand when the information comes out about what they knew, but the question is, what did they know at the moment before the arrest took place? And if somebody didn't remember to mention a fact until the trial, I suppose that might go to the weight of whether you really believe that that's what the person knew before the arrest happened. But why should it make any difference when we find out what that ex ante information was?
2 points are important to that, Your Honor. First of all, Agent Beckett did testify to the collective knowledge. He was the agent at the suppression hearing, the only agent, and he testified that he was privy to what was going on. That's why they called him as a witness at the suppression hearing. He explained what his understanding, what the collective understanding was of probable cause.
And why does his view of probable cause trump the court's ability to assess what was in the collective knowledge and make a decision whether what actually happened was something that met the standard? Maybe Agent Beckett goes around with a higher standard of probable cause than the Constitution requires.
Well, you're absolutely right that he should not trump the district court. But what the district court failed to do in this case is show any deference to his expertise. He is an expert. This is not a case of, you know, obvious, oh, I saw someone hand drugs. It looked like drugs to me. Well, anyone can make that decision. We're talking about very subtle things in this case. We're talking about facial expression. We're talking about timing. We're talking about the location of a car. We're talking about, is this particular location consistent with being a lookout? Well, what direction was the person looking in? What could they see? These are very subtle things. And
did she ever proffer any explanation of what she was doing there?
She testified at trial.
When she said she was doing, how did she explain these activities?
Her explanation at trial was that she went to that particular store to shop. And she described, I don't recall specifically what she intended to purchase, but this was she's Hispanic, she's Mexican, and this is a Mexican grocery store, and she was,
she parked her car at a certain place vis-a-vis the transaction here, and she stayed in the car, as I understand. She wasn't shopping.
Well, she stayed in the car for a brief period of time, correct. A little over a minute. Well, we didn't go in. See, that brings us to this question of, are we going to look at the trial testimony or are we going to look at the suppression hearing testimony? At the trial, we didn't have an incentive. We were fighting for a not guilty verdict. We weren't arguing about probable cause. So we didn't go into the details of, well, why did you wait a minute? Was she looking through her purse? Was she counting her money? Was she checking over her grocery list? We didn't go into those details because it wasn't an issue at the trial.
See, I think the biggest hurdle that you have to overcome is the fact that the other agents, other than Agent Becca, had watched Coria leave the home of the seller, drive to the scene of the transaction, make contact with the seller 2 times, park her car within surveillance range of the transaction.
No, but Agent Becca was aware of that. Agent Becca had that collective knowledge, and he was aware of all of the facts. Now, but you're talking about other agents. Well, let's talk about Agent Hare. She was the agent who made the arrest. On this question of collective knowledge, there's no reason to believe she had collective knowledge. First of all, she didn't testify at the suppression hearing. So we don't have any assessment of her credibility. Second of all, at the trial, she was asked the question, well, did you rely on radio transmission? The government is claiming, well, she had collective knowledge because it was radio transmission. Some of the other agents explained, we disseminated this information via radio transmission. But Agent Hare, when asked about radio transmission, did you receive radio transmission? And her response was, I received some telephone calls.
But the thing is, if she's there in this group and somebody's received it and they say, now let's go, let's arrest him, I mean, that is sort of the collective group working together to handle the scene, isn't it?
Well, that requires you to make huge assumptions and huge leaps based on no factual findings.
Let me ask you something totally different, and that is, why didn't Ms. Coria move for a downward departure based on minimal participation? Or did she?
Well,
it seems she didn't.
No, I don't. You're testing my memory now, Your Honor. But my recollection, she actually got the opposite of minimal participant. She got leader organizer.
121 months.
But right, but she got leader organizer. She got the other end of, you know, you can be just part of the offense, or you can be a minimal, a minor, or it's worse than just part of the offense, you're leader organizer. She got a 2-point enhancement for being a leader organizer. Actually, they asked for a 4-point enhancement for, I would certainly have taken a minor role, but they asked for a 4-point enhancement of saying she was a leader organizer of a criminal organization involving four more people.
A different battle. Can't wait until I get up here.
I didn't want to be too greedy. I chipped off 2 points, but we didn't go any farther than that. We would gladly accept any reduction in her guideline calculation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Morning, Mr. Sheriff.
Yes. Thank you, Judge. And please, Court, Peter Giroux, I was the attorney down below also.
Would you just, before you even begin,
sure,
help me with that? Why?
Certainly, Your Honor. What the evidence showed was that Ms. Correa was acting in concert with Luis Garcia Parra, her live-in boyfriend or common-law husband. It wasn't clear exactly what their role was. There was evidence that she directed Varela, collected payments, kept an accounting of all of the assets, or the do and owe sheet, and by directing another participant and organizing it, that's what warranted it.
Evidence that was available before she was arrested, though, was it?
Oh, no. I'm sorry. I thought Judge Rovner was asking about the role in the offense.
Yeah, I am.
Yes. Uh-huh. And those were the factors, and it's articulated by the court at sentencing. And in that particular case, she found that she did organize, she did direct, these activities of at least Varela at a minimum, and perhaps even Arturo. Only that was unclear, and I'm not asserting that was the case, but certainly Varela, one other person she was directing. And again, I don't have those exact facts in front of me because I wasn't prepared for that, but I think the PSR and her sentencing statements make that clear.
I guess I could look for it, but did she have an extensive criminal history?
No, sir. No, ma'am.
No, I didn't think so.
No, Your Honor. She had no
why?
Criminal history. Your Honor, in terms of the Ms. Correa, I'd like to go directly to that argument that Mr. Ruth was talking about, and that really deals with probable cause to arrest. The evidence that the trial court had was not only the testimony of Agent Becca, but she also had exhibits, which were the police reports of the arrests on the 9th and the 25th, and those things were all communicated.
And what's the evidence? What Mr. Ruth was arguing was that we're just making an assumption somehow that this information was all communicated one to the other.
Right, Your Honor, and that is all based upon the idea of the collective knowledge doctrine. And as this court's ruled in Sawyer, if the police officer's in communication, then the evidence of all the officers is imputed into the officer, and it doesn't matter whether they actually knew it or not.
So we don't care about the content of the communications? They could have been talking about, you know, basketball scores or...
Well, we know that they were in communication and they were communicating this way, and this is how we do know. Agent Wall, who was up in the airplane when they took the video surveillance of the entire event, testified that he was in radio communications with all the surveillance officers.
That's a C-26?
Yes, it is.
And that they didn't notice?
Well, it was
flying over them?
It was flying at approximately 12,000 feet.
Oh, okay.
So they could not see it. But through special means, they were able to reduce the level of photographing down to, I think it was around 7,000 feet. In any event, Your Honor, the testimony was that he was in communication with those surveillance officers. The surveillance officers were all in radio communication with each other. And therefore, the inference is, if you wish, that if he's in communication with surveillance officers, the surveillance officers are in radio communication with each other, then Agent Hare, who testified that she was acting as a surveillance officer on page 61 of the transcript, and when asked the specific question on page 68 of that transcript, the question was not, she didn't deny she's in radio communications. The specific question was, on line 13 of page 68, did you get some kind of radio transmission telling you that the first arrest had occurred? And the answer is, radio transmissions, I was getting numerous cellular phone calls throughout the transactions. In other words, they were in communication with each other. I would suggest, granted, it perhaps could have been clear, but I would suggest that the testimony is they're in radio communication and she's on a cell phone as they're going through this big deal with these four different agencies following them down to Chicago and then all the way back up. And that is why we believe that the radio communication, you can rightfully infer that that knowledge is imputed that all the officers had starting back at the first deal on June 20th. It's not like they were sitting there saying, okay, let's all now review it, and then communicated it that day. But that the notion is that now officers that knew different things at different points now were able to come to the conclusion, yes, arrest her.
I am sorry to take you back again. I'm obsessed about these sentences. Why was Correa's sentence so much higher than Garcia's, when both were convicted as lookouts and conspirators in the same drug transaction?
Well, Your Honor, because Varela's testimony, and that would have been made more clear in the transcript, but Varela's testimony, the co-conspirator that acted at this thing, he basically testified that she was directing him in terms of what actually went on. And it's difficult for me to cite to those particular parts of the record right now, but I can tell the court that an examination of the record would show that Varela talked about Correa ordering him to a meeting right before the 1 kilo deal, showing him a firearm, telling him he owed $1,700, and I can't remember if he testified that she showed him some sort of odd knife out of a pen or something at that point, but it was the notion that Correa herself was acting as a concomitant organizer, a leader of this group, both in charge of the assets in terms of the money due and owing, and in directing Varela on what to do and how to do things. Specifically, on the actual day of the deal, Varela testified that as he was going to look at the cocaine with the undercover, Mr. Luna, as they were walking towards that, I'm sorry, I didn't get any light.
No, you're fine.
As they were walking, Correa called him over, and at that point told him, did you get the money? Have you seen the money? And he says, no, I haven't, or words to that effect. And she said, well, that's not the way we do the deal. In other words, she knows exactly the ways the deals are coming down. And she's basically directing him, you better see the money first. Now, that along with mainly the organizational aspects of controlling the assets and directing Varela, those things qualify her certainly as a leader in that regard.
Maybe that should take us over to Mr. Garcia then. We talked a fair amount about the expertise of Agent Becca, but his lawyer is also suggesting that the only thing the evidence really shows is that he wanders up and down streets, and maybe that's not enough to convict him of serving as a lookout or a surveillance agent.
And what you really have here is testimony that he knew, obviously, and perhaps this is not the most telling point, but I think it's significant, is that Arturo Garcia Parra was basically living with his brother, Luis Garcia Parra, who was the person that seems to be the man that was able to get the dope and was basically dealing with Varela. That association, coupled with the activities on that day, and then the statement to Varela later after the event and in jail, where he told Varela, Varela turned him and says, why were you there? And Arturo said, I was there because Luis thought you were going to steal the money, or that there was going to be a ripoff. And I would only direct the court's attention to the other decision, Elizondo, which I cited in the brief, in which case the court found there was sufficient evidence in that case. The defendant Collins in that case simply basically did what Arturo Garcia Parra did. He went to a deal, picked up the drugs, brought them back, and acted as a lookout. and that was sufficient evidence.
Why do you think living in the house matters, though? I mean, people could live in the house with somebody else without being part of a drug conspiracy.
Your Honor, that is absolutely true, and I wouldn't suggest that mere association in any form means that you're part of some deal. But in all these cases, and especially a conspiracy, there's little facts taken together and brought together indicate that it is not simply innocent behavior. And again, I only point that out because I don't think I made it a point in my brief that, in fact, they knew each other. Maybe I thought it was obvious, I don't know, but I thought that I would bring that to the court's attention now because I think it is important to know that it wasn't that he just showed up one day without knowing anybody. He introduced Barella to Luis. Again, that's another factor.
Were the two sentences based on the same drug quantities? Just out of curiosity.
I can't recall right now. I want to say yes. I cannot recall.
Okay. How, well, will the records tell us how often you have such complicated, complex investigations, airplanes flying to Chicago, airplanes flying back from Chicago. I'm going to keep my eyes up in the air from now on. Will the record tell us how often you get into all that?
No, I don't.
And complexity and.
Your Honor, and I don't think the record will show that. And obviously, the government, in the sense of the United States Attorney's Office, doesn't make the decisions on how investigators use their resources or what they do with those resources. Of course, aware of Western District of Wisconsin, sometimes cases that don't seem like a big deal someplace else are a pretty big deal up there. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we're faced with as a district. But I do not think that the record will reveal that, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was a little startled, too. It's a military airplane, right?
It is a military.
Taking a break on the war on terrorism for this little cocaine deal.
It is a military airplane, Your Honor, and it was used in this situation.
Okay.
Unless the court has any more questions, I can...
Just tell me this.
Certainly.
When I was reading the briefs, it seemed to me that the only thing that you had linking Garcia Parra to any drug transactions other than the July 10th transaction was the word of Varela.
Is that true? Right, and that was only used for sentencing purposes. In other words, that was used...
Oh, but what else counts?
I understand, Your Honor, but he was convicted on the evidence that was before the trial court in Leastwood at that point. And I understand what the court's saying, but that was at the sentencing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
But you were done, weren't you?
I was.
I don't want to thank you if you're not.
I was, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Stengel.
Thank you. Just briefly, I wanted to touch on this familial association that the court asked Mr. Giroux about. Arturo Garcia Parra, this was a small conspiracy of about five members. It was a familial conspiracy. And I think it's important for the court to note that the government stipulated during the trial that subject to a search warrant, no evidence of drug dealing as it related to Arturo Garcia Parra was found at the home. There were no cell phone records or typical tools of the trade, I guess is the way to put it, linking Arturo Garcia Parra into this conspiracy. You have the fact that he was in his brother's car when they came down to Chicago and returned. And I just want to touch briefly upon the argument that at the Daubert hearing, I argued that the evidence should be excluded under 403. And I just want to touch base on that, if the court allows me, briefly, because it ties in to what we believe is the lack of evidence bringing in Arturo Garcia Parra and the effect of Agent Becca's testimony. And this court has cautioned against, although it has allowed in certain cases, this dual role of investigating agent and expert. And I think that, for example, in the Doe case and DeSoto, I think that if you look at Agent Becca's testimony, it's difficult to discern what he's basing his opinion on, whether it's his observations as an eyewitness to this or his expertise. And I think that is the crux of the problem that can lead to jury confusion. How do the jury have the same evidence that Agent Becca had in
But the district court addressed all of this. I mean, you really had the district court taking those measures and cautioning the jury about precisely this problem.
There was a cautionary instruction as it related to his expert testimony, yes. But I think that based on at least the government's position that somehow because of this association was important, I think it highlights the problematic nature of his testimony. So unless the court has any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Collective knowledge, if there are two words that have the most significance to this question of probable cause, it's collective knowledge. Look at what the government is asking you to do. First of all, remember, with collective knowledge, it's the government's burden to prove the collective knowledge. Okay? In this particular case, they proved it with Jerry Becca. Agent Becca was the witness at the suppression hearing. They didn't begin to prove it with Agent Hare or any other agent from the trial testimony. So they want to say, well, you should interpret what Agent Hare, she talked about receiving phone calls. She didn't say what those phone calls were about, but she talked about receiving phone calls. The other agent said they disseminated the collective knowledge via radio transmission. So now the government is asking this court, who has had no opportunity to see these witnesses, to look at their demeanor, to put this evidence together.
Or ever will.
The government's asking this court to make this leap of faith about collective knowledge. That is a finding for a court to make, for a district court to make. The government didn't ask the district court in this case to make that particular finding. Now, the fact that the government, you know, they see how important this is. They need collective knowledge to hook in Agent Hare. And their only basis for doing it is to look at trial testimony where there were no factual findings. You can't make that huge leap. And if you want a specific example of the danger of this court trying to make those factual findings now, look at the testimony of Agent Chamulak. That's how you pronounce his name. Agent Chamulak. Now, the government is saying, rely on what he said, because he said that he saw Magdalena Correa looking at this drug transaction. Okay? Here's what his trial testimony was. First, he said, I saw her look intently at Mr. Varela. Well, on cross-examination, we found out that, well, he couldn't see her face, he couldn't see the expression on her face, and he really couldn't tell what she was looking at. All he saw was her head turn in his direction. Now, could a judge make a factual finding that he looked intently? Possibly. I think it's a stretch, but possibly. But this court can't make that factual finding, because this court isn't a fact-finding court. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. And the case, of course, will be taken under advisement. Thank you.